Hello and welcome to another episode on the podcast show Unbroken, Healing Through Storytelling. I'm your host, Madeleine Black. I have met so many amazing people along my own journey and I will be sharing their stories with you. They have all overcome adversity and have not just bounced back in life, but forward. Their stories will motivate, inspire and offer hope. And I really believe that a story heard at the right time has the power to transform and that none of us are broken beyond repair.
Unbroken, healing through storytelling.
Today, I'm very excited to speak to my guest because she is an incredible woman and you will be amazed at her story, but she's also a really dear friend and I'm excited. So today, my guest is Natalie Koresh. You know, I've never asked you how I pronounce your surname, is that right?
It's Koresh, but don't worry about it,
honestly. Okay.
I have so many variations, trust
me. I'm sure you do. Natalie is the best-selling author of Still Standing, a professional motivational speaker, passionate anti-knife crime, anti-youth violence specialist, and multiple award-winning charity fundraiser. Friday, March the 4th, 2016, in broad daylight, 8 months pregnant, Natalie, on leave from her professional career, was stabbed 24 times in the street with a 12-inch carving knife by a disguised attacker in a calculated and vicious attempted murder lasting a horrific 9 minutes in total. Despite suffering appalling life-critical wounds, Natalie and her baby, against all medical odds, survived, but with life-changing physical and emotional damage, the latter being extensively added to by the discovery of who exactly the disguised attacker was and a world of lies and of deceit unfolding. Since her horrendous ordeal, Natalie has changed her life completely, leaving behind a 19-year successful career in the pharmaceutical industry to start up two businesses, Natalie Q Inspired Limited and a non-for-profit community interest company, Inspired to Quit Blades, ITQB.
Within a split second, he stabbed me straight through the chest, and not just once, but repeatedly. And life goes into slow-mo. If we were watching this on a film, it'd just be like, everything would go. And I remember getting to my feet, the adrenaline, that fight or flight, it was that survival mode. But I collapsed very quickly. When I came round, the attacker too broke free. This was a premeditated murder attempt. And this is really bizarre, but I felt like I wanted to hug him goodbye.
There's always hope. Unbroken, healing through storytelling.
How are you?
I'm good, thank you. So lovely to see you. It's been ever so long, COVID.
It's way too long. So because my show is called Unbroken, the very first question I ask everyone is, what does the word unbroken mean to you?
Yeah, it's a really good question because I think with unbroken, we all talk about moments in our lives where we all say we're broken. You know, we're at the end of our tether, something awful's happened and that's it. We do feel broken. We do feel that. But to me, unbroken is about the sense of our spirit. And I always think of our spirit as a little flame inside of us. And this isn't being religious, although I did come from a Catholic background, but I am the worst Catholic in the world. So it's nothing religious at all. But it's about us having this little flame inside of us. And no matter what, that flame is there, I believe, until our heart stops beating and we stop breathing. Yeah. And even though it might dampen right down in those really hard times, it's like a smouldering fire. And once we nourish it, it comes back up. And to me, unbroken is that flame that always keeps going, that therefore our spirit is never fully broken.
It's like that fire in your belly that we're all born,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah.
I like that definition. That's lovely. It can never be distinguished, whatever happens to us. Yeah, so can you take us back to before this event in your life? It's event, not even the right word. How were things at home? You're 8 months pregnant, you know, excited, yeah, waiting for the birth of your baby with your partner, Bobby, that you had re-met again on social media after your marriage had finished.
Yeah, and that the thing is life was in some happy bubble. And that's the weird thing about it all is that... you know, there's no telling of what life term was going to take place. You could almost say I had quite a mundane routine life insofar as it was suburbia, lovely area that I lived in. Bobby and I had our house. I had two children already for my previous marriages, he said, been married before, I got on really well, still with my ex-husband, which I know can be unusual, but actually we do get on well. You know, we shared sort of, you know, big parenting duties still together. So my children were 10 and 6 at this point in 2016, working in the pharmaceutical industry, as you rightly say. And here I was thinking, this was like a second chance of the happy family. So when Ian and I married, my ex-husband and I married, I thought that was going to be for life. Clearly it wasn't. And being with Bobby, having this baby that he so wanted, made me feel, but you know what? This is it happening again. And here I was just coming to this conclusion of this whole, you know, having another child, 8 months pregnant and everything's all good, about to start maternity leave, that sort of happy place, like trepidation, knowing that I was going to be a mum again. And I was just turned 40, and so it was a big thing, sort of, you know, I hadn't expected to have a third child at the age of 40. But apart from that trepidation of being a mum again to a, you know, to an infant, it was all good.
And Bobby was someone that you knew from way back, wasn't he? You knew him from school, and you met again through social media.
Yeah, I mean, we met when we were 14, 15. He was a year above me at school. I went to an all-girls grammar school. He went to an all-boys grammar school. So we used to get the bus home together because they were literally quite like close to each other. So you can imagine, like, girls on the bus, boys on the bus, both single-sex schools. It was all like, rah! And we became friends through that. And I used to date one of his friends, weirdly. So, but we also had this wider group. So some of my friends from school, when we went to university, ended up marrying his friends because they ended up at the same uni. So the wider circle had always been in contact. And although Bobby and I lost contact when we went to university, I just knew what was going on. I knew what he was doing. He was always the same person. Everyone talked about him. He was like, he's funny, he's kind, he's happy, he's very caring about his family, but he'd never got married. So here I am in 2016, I'm 40, he's 41, I'm on my third child, he's about to have his first. So in that sense, our lives have been quite different. So he'd never done the settled down thing before up to this point.
So. And on the day you were due to meet him, weren't you, and you had a phone call from him in the morning. Can you tell us about the phone call?
Yeah, so he'd gone off to work that morning, and he talked about a bank appointment that he was going to go to at the lunchtime. And he phoned me to say, oh, that the bank appointment being delayed to 3:30 in the afternoon. And could I go with him? Could I get my mum to collect the girls from school? Because I'd been doing school run. I was a day off work. And he said, well, will you come with me? And he insisted on picking me up. And I kept saying, no, you don't need to pick me up, don't be daft, blah, blah. He's like, no, I want to pick you up, I want to pick you up. Luckily, in many ways, when I reflect back, I'm quite stubborn, and I didn't wait for him to come and collect me. I actually set off, and I set off to Sutton, and I phoned him as I left the house. He told me he was stuck in traffic. He was all, oh, my gosh, I'm sorry, I'm running late, I'm still stuck on the other side of Birmingham, blah, 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 blah. I told him not to worry, that I was going to walk down and go shopping and just to phone me when he got there. And his final words were, I love you. He said, okay, if you're sure. He goes, I love you. And I said, I love you too. And I hung up. And the weird thing is you can just picture the scene. You know, I'm 8 months pregnant. I'm walking into this town centre. I'm in a nice area. Mm-hmm. It was raining. I remember having my umbrella up. I'm just thinking about what I'm going to get, you know, as we do, thinking my shopping list in my head. Minding my own business, 3 o'clock Friday afternoon, and literally I didn't know I was walking into this absolute hellhole. There's no other way of describing it. You know, this absolute moment of terror was going to come upon me within the next 15, 20 minutes.
And it was the 4th of March, 2016, and you're walking down a particular hill called Trinity Hill, which was, it kind of spooked you sometimes really, didn't it?
Yeah, Trinity Hill had a bit of a history. So Trinity Hill is in Sutton Coldfield, which is North Birmingham in central of the Midlands in England. So Trinity Hill has this history that 20 years before, a girl had been murdered on there. So she was the girl's only, I'm trying to think how old Nicola was, I think she was 17 when she was murdered. She was about 4 years younger than me. I'd just come back from university. It was a New Year's Eve, snowy New Year's Eve, and she was actually raped and murdered, and her body was found on New Year's Day on that very hill. And a memorial stood to her at the top of the hill. So for me, there's always this sense of great sadness. I'm not... It's really hard thing when I say, do I believe in the spirituality? There's a degree insofar as I always felt this sense of something there. You could tell that something horrific had happened. But Nicola, the girl who got murdered, she was a fighter. And everything they found from examining her body and when they eventually found the attacker, and it took years to find the guy who murdered her, was that she'd put up a fight. So although she'd been on her own, she'd really clawed back, she'd tried to escape, and you know, she had a real spirit about her, and she was just in a circumstance. There was no way that she could be saved. He was a much larger man, and yeah, she came to her demise upon that hill. But she didn't give in without a fight. So there's a memorial to her at the top, and it always made me a bit wary of going down there by myself because this sense of foreboding.
You felt that presence, really, didn't you? The heaviness of it all. But you're walking down the street and you hear this, the thudding of footsteps behind you. Can you take us through what happened on that day?
Yeah, so the beginning of Trinity Hill, it is a hill, and it's quite a steep downhill. And as I'm walking down it, it's a tree-lined alleyway. So to picture the scene, you've got this sort of wide, and when I say alleyway, it's really wide, with a churchyard on the one side of you with a high wall, and there's these trees over the top. And I'm there, so it's quite dark, it's quite secluded, and I start to hear this running, and I look over my shoulder, and there's a man, and he's got his head down, he's got his hood right up, and my heart starts pounding. A sixth sense, whatever, told me, I don't know, this guy's coming for me. And I remember I sped up because I thought, I just need to get out, because Trinity Hill opens out into a dead-end road, and I thought, if I can get out there, there's cars parked, I could see a man walking up the hill, and there were some buildings, and I thought, I'll be safe. And I made it to that point. I actually got out of the tree-lined alleyway part. I got out in the open, and like I say, take you back, it's 3 o'clock on a Friday afternoon. I can see the town centre ahead of me, like, I don't know, McDonald's is only a couple of hundred yards ahead, in effect, of me. And I'm thinking, I'm safe. I genuinely thought I was safe. And then I realised, without even looking over my shoulder, that this man was now right behind me. You know, that physical presence when someone's so, so close behind you. My heart's pounding. And I thought, if I just step to one side, one of those very clear, you know, go past sort of thing. I feel uncomfortable with you there. And I did do that. I stepped out of the way. And as I stepped out of the way, he jumped on me, literally jumped on me from behind and pulled me backwards into him. And I thought I was being mugged. That was my first thought, was I'm being mugged. I've got this big baby bump. I've walked down a secluded alleyway. This is almost classic, you know, sort of woman alone, vulnerable woman at that with a pregnancy. And I'm being mugged for my handbag. And I wish to say it was for my handbag. But before I knew it, the attacker drew out a knife. And within a split second, that knife was being used to attack
me. It wasn't just a knife, it was a huge, great big knife, really, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, this is the thing. It was, you can imagine, his arms clasped around me, and so his left arm is clasped with me to his body, and his right arm was free, and it was up in the air. And I remember at the corner of my eye, suddenly caught the sight of this blade, and it was a 12-inch kitchen carving knife. You know, we're talking huge knife. And I was thinking, mate, you don't need that. What? You don't take my bag. But within a split second, he stabbed me straight through the chest, and not just once, but repeatedly. And life goes into slow-mo. If we were watching this on a film, it'd just be like everything would go and slow down. Because you're sort of seeing it, you're feeling it, but your head is still in this denial of, this can't be happening to me.
Which is, quite a good thing that our head detaches, because if it stayed in that trauma, I think it would have been too much for you.
Yeah, and I do believe, I know with, you know, everything, with, you know, with all the horrific things that happened to you, you know, happened to yourself, it's our way of, I truly believe it's our body's way of coping. Our brain is so clever, it almost just unplugs slightly, and you go into this systematic thing. I remember looking down and seeing that my top was ripped. I remember seeing the blood and then thinking, I'm being stabbed. I remember actually thinking the words, I'm being stabbed. And you're thinking, how you could think so logically with all these, but it was the only way, and I'm sure you can relate to this, it's the only way I could cope, was to go into this sort of stepwise little details, you know, where you just go through it. And I couldn't break free. I tried. I think that was a very hard thing for me to come to terms with after the attack, was the fact I couldn't break free. Because I was, you know, I'm half Portuguese, hence the dodgy surname, but my dad's Portuguese, and I'm quite Latina in my character, quite strong and quite stubborn, as I say, quite sort of. And I thought, if someone jumped on me, I'd be able to get them off, even though I'm little. And I, you know,
a 12-inch carving knife and 8 months pregnant.
I know, yes. And it's awful because, you know, I remember thinking, well, why couldn't I break free? And it's so hard at first to accept.
Well, just think of shock. your mind and body went into total shock, and you've been stabbed as well. But it kind of happens in about three parts, really, doesn't it? Because some people did hear the first time that he was going for you, and they came to your aid, didn't they?
Yeah, so two men came running. The man that I'd seen, the man that I'd almost had that reassurance I'd be fine, mm-hmm. he came running. His name's John. There's another man called Tony who's coming down the hill behind the attacker. And both of them were so brave. They jumped on this man. I mean, this is a stranger who's wielding a knife with this other person who, you know, I'm not related to them. And God bless them, they jumped on him. They pulled him down, but the attacker kept attacking me. So the attacker dragged me down with him. At one point, I broke free because they held his arm down with the knife, so he let go of me. And I remember getting to my feet, the adrenaline, that, you know, fight or flight. It was that survival mode. But I collapsed very quickly. When I came round, the attacker too broke free from the two men and started again. And it was only because an 18-year-old lad who heard the shouts for help came running. He ripped the attacker off me, and he was followed by three police officers who, when they arrived, the attacker was at me for a third time. So it was relentless. You know, it literally felt at the time, this just isn't going to end.
And he wasn't just attacking you, he was punching you in the face, really trying to knock you out, wasn't he?
Yes, yeah. So he went from stabbing to trying to knock me out. He had the knife in the one side of my face while he punched me, which he did knock me out. And that was, and then I came around, he was still continuing the attack. So it was a really horrifically traumatic, violent attack, and something that was so out of anything that I'd ever imagined or thought I could possibly experience. And all the while, I was trying to reason with him. I remember talking to him, thinking, well, if I could make myself human. I remember saying to him, you know, I'm a mum, please don't kill me. I have two children already. And all the while, I'm doing this reasoning, thinking this man's going to stop, but clearly he didn't, because, as you said, you know, in the beginning, it turned out to be my partner who was doing the attack. And this was a premeditated murder attempt. He wasn't going to stop until I gave up the fight, as it were. And
it was a completely shocking part, because you didn't find this information out until you had been airlifted by Midlands ambulance crew away to hospital. And you were moments, really, from both of you passing away.
Yeah, so the police who arrived at the scene, they started first aid, which is a very key reason. I talk to young people about the reality of knife crime, and I always say, if the police hadn't been there to give first aid, I'd have passed away, because, they were stemming the blood flow very quickly.
Would have passed away.
Yeah, absolutely. And then, as you write, I was airlifted, and when they airlifted me, they made all sorts of decisions, again, which were critical, that, you know, my right lung had collapsed, but they didn't put chest drain in, because if they did, I would have passed away, and, you know, my little one certainly would have. And it was taken that my little one had
gone by about 2 or 3 millimetres or something, didn't it?
Yeah. So when they had me in surgery, they actually, when they delivered her, they worked on me first to try and get me, you know, back. Then when they delivered Leah, she was actually passed, she wasn't breathing, she was pale, she was floppy, totally unresponsive, and they thought, let's give this a shot. I think it's about 5 minutes, they worked on her, and she suddenly came around, and they put her into a coma, they cooled her body down to try and sort of preserve her brain. Her brain had been massively affected from blood loss, you know, she'd been starved of oxygen, so my blood supply was poor to her, very poor. And she was kept in a coma, as was I, but she was kept,
you were kept in a coma as well, weren't you? And you didn't know that you had become a mum or that she survived until once you had woken up.
No, it's really surreal. So I come round, you come out of the coma, you're in critical care, and I've got no family around me, because this is now a murder or attempted murder investigation. Nobody was allowed to speak to me apart from the medics and the police. So I've got a nurse and a doctor, and they tell me that she's alive, and it's like, wow, that's amazing. But my head's still processing, okay, how did that happen? Because I knew I'd received 3 stab wounds to my stomach alone. So at the 24 I got, 11 were in my chest, I had them down my side, and 3 were in my right into the belly. So I thought, she's gone. So it's great, but they're saying, well, you can't see her. She's in a coma. She's in a different hospital. And I remember having to almost put my hand down to my stomach to realise that there wasn't a baby there, because you've not gone through this natural birthing process. You know, you're being told you're a mum, but you know nothing about the fact that you've delivered a baby. So it's a really strange thing in my head. It took days for it almost to come to terms with the fact that there wasn't a baby anymore in my stomach.
And it was around this time the police came to you to tell you that actually the attacker was your partner, Bobby, who had disguised himself.
Yeah, so there's a police guard at the end of my bed, and I could see these formal-looking people, and they then came to the bedside and said, Natalie, we need to talk to you about the attack. We need to ask you what you remember. And I told them what I remembered, and then after they broke the news that the person they arrested at the scene, so he was caught literally red-handed and being charged with my attempted murder and being held at the police station, was my partner, and everything shattered. Everything. When we were talking about the shattered, that was...
I can imagine what that must have done to you. How could you actually take that information on board?
I just remember lying there and silently just crying and just... I think my first response, weirdly, also was, I wanted to speak to him. Mm-hmm. And they're like, you can't. And I was almost like, but I wanted, because, you know, he'd got up that morning, you know, the morning of the attack, he'd got up out of bed next to me, he'd kissed me, we'd chatted, you know, and I was thinking...
And there was no sign of any abuse, nothing in your relationship at all, just to make...
No, and that's a really weird thing, is that people, you know, it's always thought, well, was there anything? And it's like, no, he was never violent, he was no coercive control, there's no emotional abuse. It literally, for me, came out of nowhere. Although clearly in his head and his mind, these things have been building up in terms of what he was building up to, been building for a long time, because obviously people don't tend to commit murder without there being something. And that didn't come out until well after the attack, when I almost became a detective in my own story to try and find out the true reasons why. And then I started to find out all these lies, all this deceit and all this double life. So all these things that I believed to be true and things he told me, I was suddenly finding, well, that's not true. Well, that's not true. And I thought he might have a second family. That was my initial concern, was that there was actually maybe another woman, a wife or something, but there wasn't. But there was a cultural gap between us, where his family came from a different culture and he was trying to almost pretend he was within that culture when he was with his family, but then, like, his mother and things, then living with me and going, well, I can do what I want. And he led, in effect, at least a double life, if not a triple, quadruple, but definitely a double life. Mm-hmm. So
how do you begin to recover from hearing the information that was him and the physical results of the attack, and also the emotional results of the attack?
Physically, it was just, it was like some treadmill. You know, I had to keep having surgery. He'd really damaged my hand. The knife had gone through the side of my wrist, mm-hmm. and he'd cut through my wrist as well. So I'd got the nerves and the tendons were damaged. So I can't feel half my hand still. I've had to have multiple surgeries, still have surgery to come in. So it's like, even when I was discharged, I was constantly going back to the hospital. And that, I guess, in a way, it almost became my security, because that was my routine, was just going to the hospital, seeing medics, talking, coming home, you know, and that was my new routine. The mental side was horrific, was absolutely horrific. People would see me. I remember asking for my makeup bag just before I got discharged. I said to my sister, can someone bring my makeup in? And they were all like laughing, oh, look, Nat's back to Nat. You know, she's asking for a makeup. But, and I'm sure you can relate to this, I needed to put on a mask, and I needed to, for me, I needed to make myself look, especially to my children, I had to make myself look as normal, in inverted commas, as possible. And it was my mask. I couldn't let people, if I slipped and let people know what was going on in my head, I felt that I would be in such a deep, dark place that I couldn't come back.
But there's a price to pay, isn't there, for putting a mask on?
Yeah. Because everyone, first of all, everyone assumes you're all right and that you're a lot better than you really are. You're dealing with these flashbacks. You're dealing with a lot of guilt, trauma.
What's the guilt about?
because he was my partner, because I'd brought him into the family with, first of all, I brought him into the lives of my two children. And I just thought, I can't believe I brought someone like that into the lives of my children.
Did you have a crystal ball? Did you have any way of knowing that this was going to happen?
You sound just like my psychologist now.
Sorry, I'll stop the therapy stuff.
And that's exactly it, is that I was really...
Misplaced guilt is what you're saying. A lot of misplaced guilt.
Yeah, exactly. And it was that, because I saw my psychologist. I was really, really so blessed that I was given this psychologist. And I was with her for 3.5 years. I absolutely love her and adore her, because it was through therapy, and I had to have post-traumatic stress disorder therapy as well, much further down the line, that got me back. And it got me seeing about my sense of self-worth. Because you imagine, my self-worth was destroyed. Because I thought, when you get to the point that somebody wants to take you off this earth, that clearly just destroys the self of who you are. Because you think,
how little I am worth if they think I'm only good enough to be killed and removed. Yeah, I get that.
And that's how I felt. I thought, what does that say about me? And she built up my self-worth and said rightly what you said, Natalie, nobody saw it. Nobody ever dreamed he could ever do anything like he did. There were no warning signs, and you can't be blamed for, loving a person and trusting them when they've given you no reason to think otherwise. But trauma does bring a horrible sense of guilt, and you're dealing with the gossips, because you can imagine the media have gone crazy. The media have got it all over the place. With the stereotype, they're a middle-class couple from this nice middle-class background, and look at this horrific attempted murder in the street, and she's pregnant, and all this speculation, what caused it? I even had my neighbour at the time, who actually asked me to my face whether the baby was actually his, and I just looked at her in shock. She literally nodded at the car seat, and she said, "So, is she his?"
So many judgments and assumptions. Yeah. And gossip is so dangerous, isn't it?
Yeah, and she actually said, "Well, a lot of people are talking, and people are wondering if the baby's really his, and maybe that's why he did it, because he found out that the baby wasn't." And I was like, no, this isn't Jeremy Kyle. No. But people always, it's the victim blaming in this country, because I really do believe, well, not probably in this country, in the world, people will turn and examine the victim and examine the victim's behaviour.
Forget the perpetrator.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Same with a lot of crimes that are against our person, really, isn't it? Everything.
And it's like, what has she done that makes her almost slightly culpable? And it's like, no, can you not accept that it's 100% the perpetrator?
I was going to say, there can be nothing, even if the baby hadn't been his, there can be nothing that ever justifies what he did. So he was sent to prison, wasn't he, Bobby?
Yeah, he was sent down for 18 years. He pleaded guilty to attempted murder of myself, attempted murder of our baby, wounding of two of those passers-by, and carrying a knife in public. So he had 5 charges, which he pled guilty to all. He got sentenced 18 years to serve a minimum 12.
But he's still inside at the moment.
He is inside at the moment.
And this is the part that people might struggle to understand, but you really wanted to sit opposite him and meet with him and ask him, I guess, really, why? Try to understand. And you had that meeting, didn't you?
I did. As I said, from even in the hospital, I was determined, I want to speak to him. And I remember the police kept saying to me, Natalie, you can't. It's a criminal investigation. You can't. And I said, well, as soon as it's over, I want to see him. And I think almost on the day of sentencing, I turned around to the lead police investigator and went, you know what I'm going to ask now? And he said, you want to speak to him, don't you? I went, yeah. But there's a huge process. Restorative justice is obviously the process of people who are facing their perpetrators. I know you well know. And I needed that time. I needed that empowerment to make him look at me. In court, he wouldn't look at me. He refused to look at me. And I was like, no, you're going to face me. You're going to face what you did. We're going to talk about what you did. We're going to talk about the impact of what you did. And it took from March 2016 was the attack. June 2016 was his sentencing. But then it was June 2017, a whole year on, before I walked through those prison gates. It was a It was a battle. It was a battle to get in there.
And did you get the answers that you wanted from his questions?
I think the good thing is that I'd gone in there not expecting to verbally get answers from him. It's more about how he reacted and his personality that gave me so much more. So he remained quite detached through our conversation. He was very calm and controlled. Now, this is a man who, his reasoning was that his mother's disapproval of our relationship had driven him mad, had driven him temporarily, what they call a temporary adjustment disorder. But he was apparently fine now, but he'd forgotten what he'd done, which was, when you look at the intricacies of the attack, it doesn't even make sense, because he was very cold throughout the attack. And even when he came after me, when I ran away, he apparently walked towards me. He didn't run at me. When the police arrived, he gave himself up straight away. Now, if this is someone who's lost their mind, you'd expect them to carry on the attack and the police have to tackle him to the ground. And when I faced him, you would expect a man who said he had a temporary psychosis, in effect, would therefore be distraught. You know, he's faced with me and he'd go, oh, I can't believe I did that to you. And he wasn't. He was so together. And I showed him photos of my injuries. And he looked at them. He was literally pouring at them as if they were some terrible criminal journal sort of thing. And then he was looking at the injuries that he'd caused. And then he was looking at me, to parts of my body, to see if he could see the scars of what he'd left. And then in the afternoon, he admitted to having flashbacks, because I talked about my flashbacks, and he said, oh, I get those. And I literally shut myself up and went, oh, tell me about yours. Mm-hmm. They're horrific, aren't they? And he told me. And he told me everything from following me to seeing my leather jacket, knowing it was me, to holding the knife, right to the point of being arrested. And I turned to him and went, so you do remember the attack then? You can't say. And he had nothing to say then. He knew. And
what is your personal understanding of this man? Do you have your own theory?
My personal theory, and this is obviously my theory. However, I do believe there is a psychopathic tendency here. He was a man who's very controlled. So whoever met my ex-partner, Bobby, would say he was the nicest, kindest, most polite, intelligent, educated man. And whatever he told you would make him seem like the nicest, kindest person. But actually what he told you might not be truthful. And he might tell you a different version slightly. He might tell you something. He might tell his other friends something. He might tell his family something different. But whoever met him, he told the best version of himself, in effect. And that would vary. And I know for a fact that that's true. I believe he thought he was going to get away with leading this double life, sort of lying to his family, who were a victim in that way as much as myself, lying to me. And he slowly saw that things were unravelling, that I was about to have this baby. It was going to come out to his family that he's got this child that they knew nothing about. He told me they knew, but they knew nothing about. He was in financial problems. He'd been taking money from his business. He was being kicked out of his business. So that was unravelling. And I was asking questions. And he'd never been in an intimate relationship in this way where he lived with someone. So he could create his persona quite easily because he had no one to answer to. But once he was living with me, he suddenly realized, oh gosh, she's asking me things now and it's unraveling. And I believe life was unraveling and he wanted to get rid of his biggest lie, which was me. And for someone to be able to do that in such a cold way shows me that there's a deeper psychological issue, potentially a psychopath.
I tend to agree with you. After I have read your book, and I absolutely believe you. So you left the prison, but then you decided actually that you wanted to go back and give him a hug to say goodbye, to have like final closure. There must have been a mixed feeling, I guess.
Yeah, it's a really, for so many people read that, they're like, oh my gosh, you did what? I'm sat opposite him, and there's half of me that's relating to a man I've known 25 years, and there's half of me that's going, but you're the man who created this. And I went downstairs. So I was upstairs in this offender rehab room, right in the middle of the prison, and they took me downstairs. He was left with these two prison guards at the end of the meeting, and I was still like this. And I remember the prison guard said to me, Natalie, is there anything else that you need to ask him? I've been there all day. Mm-hmm. Because, or is there anything else you need to do? Because this is your only chance. So I knew I was never going to see him again. This was me walking away from him for good. And this is really bizarre, but I felt like I wanted to hug him goodbye. And they said, well, no, it's not, because actually can tell that you've got all this history there. That
yeah, there was.
I needed to say goodbye. I needed to say goodbye to Bobby, who left home that morning, and it's almost like saying goodbye to this character, I guess, is a way of putting it. That was my grieving process. It was a grieving process because the man who left home died on March the 4th. He did die, and there's this other man still there. And actually, it's like a Jekyll and Hyde. So the nice guy died, and the evil side lived. And I had to say goodbye to that side for my own final closure. And the weird thing is I went upstairs, and I did actually hug him. He was allowed to have physical. The second he put his arms around me, I remember freezing. I remember my body tensing, and I was thinking, get off me. And I tried to pull free, and he hugged me that bit tighter. And for a split second, I was like, whoa. And I managed to pull away from him. And I think, actually, that empowered me so much, because actually I remember I said the biggest thing was that I couldn't break free from him in the attack, is that I managed to break free. And I stepped back, and in the end I said, I've got kids to go home to, and you've got a cell to return to. And I walked back.
The last lines in your book, which is amazing, called Still Standing, is, I was free from the prison. He was caught up inside. But more importantly, I had freed myself a little bit more from him.
Yeah.
And that line just always jumped at me. It was just so powerful that you took back your own power and control and free to start again. There were, I guess, maybe two prisoners up until that point.
Yeah, and I think, you know, no one thinks of the victims as prisoners, but they are, you know, all victims have their own prison sentence that they are serving to. And for us as victims, it's about us becoming the survivor, then becoming a thriver. And part of that journey is breaking out of that prison that we've got ourselves within. And, you know, it's been put upon us, really.
Well, and what was amazed me about your book, which I have here, which I actually think I managed to get a copy of it before you did, because we're both published by the same publishers, was actually your humour. When the ambulance are coming to the scene, and they're saying, you're going to feel a little scratch, you're saying, oh, that's no big deal, I've just been stabbed 26 times. So I think your humour has played a huge part in your recovery as well.
Well, the thing is, that paramedic, I remember, I'm in the back of this ambulance, they've cut my clothes off, they're trying to see, and they're trying to get a line in. And this poor guy, he kept going, sharp scratch, nasty sharp scratch, because they couldn't get this line in the end of the seven. I was like, mate, I've just been stabbed lots of times, you don't need to say sharp scratch, it's fine, just crack on.
But they were amazed as well that they were expecting to find someone unconscious, and you're not just conscious, but you're cracking jokes with them, almost, as you say, willing yourself to stay alive, or your stubbornness.
Yeah. Yeah, it was that sense of trying to have that normality. You know, it's that sort of out-of-body experience that you've got to detach from whatever, you know, they're working on this. And the only bit that they're not working on is my head at this point. And this bit has to keep me breathing. This bit has to stay alive. This bit has to stay focused while they do everything down below.
Focus to have in that moment when you must be the most traumatized you've ever been in your life.
Yeah.
So tell us now what you're doing, because I know you are passionate about ending knife crime, and you speak to young people a lot, don't you?
I do. It's all the knife crime thing, talking to young people, came out so bizarrely. So I'd done the book and I was doing professional speaking, which obviously, you know, is we met through our publishers and then obviously through the speaking arena. And it's somebody on Twitter contacted me and said, Natalie, we know you're a speaker and we know that you got stabbed. Would you come and talk to our pupils about the reality of being a stab victim? Now, I'd never considered speaking to a young audience before. It'd always been an older, more of a corporate audience. Mm-hmm. And so I went to this pupil referral unit, which is where young people go and they've been permanently excluded from school. So these are kids who've had issues, probably behavioural issues, let's be honest, at school. So, you know, I was really like, me, I'm 40 something year old woman going in, they're gonna look at me, I'm not cool, you know, they're all gonna wonder who the heck I am. And the response was phenomenal, because when I first sat down, they're like, right, I'm gonna talk to you today about knife crime, you can see them all like, we're gonna have another lecture about statistics, we're gonna see another video. And then as soon as they say, well, actually I'm the victim of a multiple stabbing, they'll go, what you miss, you. And they hear about it, and I think it gives them that sense of reality.
Yeah, I think when you speak from your heart and you are authentic, people listen. You know, they know that you're genuine, and that's really what they heard that day.
Yeah, and I've done it time and time again. So I speak in colleges, I speak in pupil referral units, I speak in schools. I'm going to the Young Offenders. I might start with them in Birmingham. And it just gives them that reality. And I've had, I had a lad recently in a session who has been in Young Offenders for knife crime. And he started, when I started to talk, he just had his head on the desk. He's like, oh, almost like, I've got this thing to you, miss. So I was talking to the rest of the group and I got my eye on him. And as I started to talk, he sort of occasionally would lift his head, like, what's that? And then his head back down, what was that again? Mm-hmm. And then also he engaged and we started chatting. And by the end, he shared so much. And you realise a lot with these young people, and especially those who had behavioural issues or got behavioural issues, it's understanding that they have gone through some horrific things themselves. And when you start learning about their background, the trauma that they've been through, the things they've witnessed, it genuinely breaks my heart. And I just think so much knife crime now, it's just escalating because people think that others are carrying knives, they might carry a knife, or they feel they've got an image because of social media has driven this thing. Or, and they're so scared, Madeline, they're so, so scared inside. And we need to make them empowered, but we also need to make them see the reality, and it's both, so they can say, well, actually, this is how bad it can be, and you deserve more than that. You are deserving of a better life than that, and that's where I want to do is change this whole mindset around knives and carrying knives and empower our young people and see our young people and get that support, because I don't believe that trauma, which is another passion of mine, is trauma is dealt with properly. With any age, young people especially, there are young people walking around with horrific trauma that don't get the support they need.
Exactly, and that's why there are behavioural issues in the first place. Rather than labelling them, let's look what's behind the labels. But it also shows you the power that comes when you share your stories. If that young man hadn't heard you that day, there's very little chance he would have opened up to anyone. So that's why I love storytelling. It's so healing. So if people want to find out more about you, Natalie, where can they get hold of you?
Yeah, I'm on all the main things like Twitter and LinkedIn and Facebook and Instagram. Crikey, you have to go through them all, don't you? Which is Natalie K. Rosh, which you obviously can see my name with it written down. It's Natalie Q. But if you also look at qinspire.co.uk, there's a piece that's got things. I did a TEDx talk, it's got sort of that in the media, it's got interviews that I've done, I've sat with Phil and Holly, that's very exciting, but you can sort of see the new stuff. And but reach out to me on social media, reach out to me. I2QB itself has got its own website, i2qb.org, for things for knife crime. But please reach out. I love hearing from people. And I've got my book, as you well say. Mm-hmm. Look, I've got yours as well. same publisher. So we got they sit next to each other in my bookcase. You know, so.
I'm honoured to be your book neighbour. But anyone listening, I will pop all of Natalie's social media details in the show notes. So if you didn't catch what she's saying, don't worry, they'll all be there for you to click on. So it just really leaves me to say thank you so much, Natalie, for coming on the show and sharing your empowering story, really. It's not just a story of trauma, it's an empowering story of how you can thrive despite major trauma and just keep on shining.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much for having me. And to everyone out there, just be kind to yourself. And if one day you feel you've just got through keeping your head above water, that's more than good enough. The one thing I learned is sometimes that's all we need to do each day. So,
perfect place to end there. Thank you.